Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the January 31st, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we have newly inaugurated President Trump in the foreground. He's sitting atop a wrecking ball, smiling. With one hand, he's holding onto the chain. With his other hand, he's giving a thumbs up. His hair is blowing in the breeze. You can see that the wrecking ball has swung through the Capitol complex. It's taken out a section of the Capitol building and part of the Supreme Court. There's kind of rubble everywhere and the sky's dark. To the side, dressed in suits and clapping at the event are Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg. The headline is Shock and Awe: How Trump's Blitz of Executive Orders Could Reshape Government and America. No surprise, there's plenty of news on that. We'll pick it up with the first main story. Trump returns with a barrage of orders, pardons. What happened? Donald Trump vowed to end America's decline this week as he was sworn in as the 47th U.S. president and issued a blizzard of executive orders aimed at radically overhauling the federal government, rewarding his most loyal supporters, and reversing the work of President Biden's administration. In a 29-minute inaugural address, Trump declared a mandate from God, who he said saved his life during an assassination attempt last summer, so he could make America great again. With Biden seated nearby, he said voters had given him a mandate to reverse a horrible betrayal by a radical and corrupt establishment. He vowed to rename the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America, said the U.S. is taking back the Panama Canal, and declared the federal government would recognize only two genders, male and female. The nation's sovereignty will be reclaimed, said Trump. Our golden age has just begun. Trump promptly began delivering on his pledges, signing several executive actions before a roaring crowd at Washington's Capital One Arena, and dozens more as the day progressed. He ordered the U.S. to exit from the Paris Climate Agreement and the World Health Organization, proclaimed an end to birthright citizenship, which is guaranteed by the Constitution, eased regulations on oil and gas extraction, and repealed a Biden order allowing transgender troops to serve in the military. Trump placed all federal staff working on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs on paid administrative leave, and overturned a 1965 order by President Lyndon Johnson setting affirmative action standards for federal contractors. He also established a Department of Government Efficiency advisory group to be run by billionaire ally Elon Musk, who in a giddy arena speech twice thrust out his right arm toward the crowd, a gesture many critics likened to a Nazi salute. Later that evening, Trump pardoned or commuted sentences for the nearly 1,600 people convicted or charged in connection with the January 6, 2021 Capitol riot. Among those pardoned were hundreds of rioters convicted of assaulting police with bats, pipes, hockey sticks, bear spray, and other weapons. Trump called them patriots who'd been railroaded by federal prosecutors. Top Republicans, Vice President J.D. Vance, and Trump himself had previously said those who committed violence would not be pardoned. But Trump reportedly shifted gears at the last minute. He just said, F it, release them all, an advisor told Axios. What the editorial said. Trump's return is a dark day, said the Philadelphia Inquirer. Back in the White House, despite two impeachments and four criminal indictments, he appears poised to dismantle guardrails that have protected the Republic from demagogues for 250 years aided by an administration stocked with loyal sycophants. Rough times are ahead for those who believe in honesty, truth, justice, and the rule of law. Trump delivered a welcome message of aspiration and optimism to the Wall Street Journal. For too long, our cultural and political elites have preached that America is awash in systemic racism and spreads destruction around the world. Trump, who praised our innovators, entrepreneurs, and pioneers, understands Americans need again believe in exceptionalism. But he erred badly in his inexcusable January 6 pardons for those convicted of bludgeoning, chemical spraying, and electroshocking police. They will prove a stain on Trump's legacy. What the columnist said. A triumphant Trump returns to a different Washington, said Peter Baker in the New York Times. The bristling tension and angry defiance he encountered in his first term have given way to accommodation and submission. The shift is evident in the million-dollar corporate donations that swelled his inaugural fund and the front-row presence at his swearing-in of cheering tech titans such as Musk, Meta's Mark Zuckerberg, and Amazon's Jeff Bezos. Meanwhile, both the progressive left and the never-Trump right are drained and demoralized. With his opening blitz, Trump aims for shock and awe, said William Crystal in The Bulwark. But don't buy in. Despite his bluster, he won the popular vote in November by a mere 1.5 percentage points. Biden won by 4.5 points in 2020. And is not as strong as everyone seems to think. He's overconfident and overreaching, and it won't end well. Democrats' task now is to shove the presidency down Trump's throat, said Jason Linkins in the New Republic. He faces a planet's worth of problems, from rising grocery prices to the war in Ukraine. Democrats must make him responsible for solving them and hammer him when he doesn't. The January 6 pardons signal just how untethered from norms Trump's second term will be, said Aaron Blake in the Washington Post. Many GOP lawmakers opposed pardoning violent offenders who injured more than 140 police officers, as did three-quarters of Americans, according to one poll. But none of that stayed his hand. The message won't be lost on members of the far-right Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, whose leaders were sprung from jail, said Noah Rothman in National Review. This is a recipe for more political violence. Trump is at war with America, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark. With a fully supplicant GOP, he's clearly gearing up to subjugate the other remaining power centers in American life. An order clearing the way for the mass firing of civil service workers is a direct attack on the federal bureaucracy. Ending birthright citizenship is a challenge meant to test the Supreme Court's nerve. The January 6 pardons are a green light for paramilitaries to commit violence on his behalf. He's on a quest for total power, and every American should be clear-eyed about what lies ahead. Controversy of the week. Gaza ceasefire. Did Trump swing the deal? After far too long and far too much death, there is for now peace in Gaza, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Under the terms of a ceasefire deal that took effect this week, Hamas released three Israeli women it has kept captive for 471 days, while Israel released 90 Palestinian prisoners. During the deal's first six-week phase, 30 more hostages should be released. Hamas still holds about 90 Israelis, living and dead, in exchange for more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. If the ceasefire holds, all living hostages will be freed in the second phase. The two sides will then negotiate a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, ending the nightmare that began on October 7, 2023, when Hamas terrorists slaughtered 1,200 Israelis and kidnapped 251 more. President Trump, who threatened Hamas with hell to pay if it didn't free the hostages by the time he took office, was quick to claim full credit for securing the deal. But the agreement is nearly identical to one the Biden administration proposed in May 2024, said Matthew Petty in Reason, raising the heartbreaking question of why this couldn't have happened sooner. Those additional 8 months of pointless violence cost the lives of thousands more Palestinians, hundreds of Israeli troops, and for what? Israel and Hamas are both relishing what they are getting and choking a bit on what they have given up, said Graham Wood in The Atlantic. But Israel is choking more. Much of Gaza lies in ruins, and at least 47,000 Palestinians are dead, according to Hamas-run health authorities. But Hamas is celebrating, having just fought a better-armed opponent to a draw. Israel, meanwhile, has failed in one of its two war goals, destroy Hamas, and achieved an agonizingly partial success in the second, free the hostages. The gradual release of living and dead hostages is a cruel twist of the ceasefire deal, said National Review in an editorial. Worse, it sets the troubling precedent that Israel and the U.S. are willing to negotiate prisoner-for-hostage deals with designated terrorist groups, which will only encourage more hostage-taking. Still, the ceasefire is a win for Trump, said Mark Champion in Bloomberg. Sure, President Joe Biden's State Department crafted the deal, but it was Trump's envoy to Israel, real estate billionaire Steve Witkoff, who got the Israelis to accept it. Reportedly, Witkoff gave Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a stark binary choice. Agree to a ceasefire before Trump's inauguration, or alienate the most amenable leader to themselves and their goals ever elected to the U.S. presidency. This is the madman theory of geopolitics in action, said Shadi Hamid in the Washington Post. Ordinarily, Netanyahu would have shrugged off Witkoff's ultimatum, reasoning that no U.S. president would abandon Israel in a fit of pique. But what a leader as emotionally volatile and dangerous as Trump? Who knows? Trump's problem, said Aaron David Miller and Daniel C. Kurtzer in the New York Times, is that by so loudly claiming the ceasefire as the first success of his presidency, he is now shackled with responsibility for the deal's fate. It's possible that after 6 weeks of calm and aid pouring into Gaza, Israel and Hamas will find it too difficult or costly to return to the fight. But it's hard to believe that Netanyahu will give up the war if Hamas remains an armed threat, or that Hamas will give up the final hostages. Its only card, without a concrete Israeli commitment to leave Gaza. The world will soon find out if this deal was simply a respite between rounds or an actual pathway to peace. So, good week, bad week segment. It was a good week for petty revenge after President Trump terminated Secret Service protection for his former National Security Advisor, John Bolton, within hours of returning to the Oval Office. Bolton, who published a book claiming the president was woefully underinformed on foreign policy matters, had received a security detail because of threats against his life from Iran. It's a good week for emoluments. After Coca-Cola CEO James Quincy presented Trump with what a Trump spokesperson described plausibly as the first ever presidential commemorative inaugural Diet Coke bottle. And it was a good week for lobbying after Bishop Marianne Edgar Budd delivering a sermon at the post-inauguration National Prayer Breakfast, beseeched Trump directly to have mercy on marginalized groups, from illegal immigrants to gay, lesbian, and transgender children. Trump later wrote online that the radical left Episcopal Bishop of Washington was nasty in tone, and her service was very boring. But it was a bad week for the shoulders of giants. After Elon Musk confirmed suspicions that he'd enlisted other gamers to spend hours leveling up the characters he's been playing in live stream video games. It's impossible to beat players in Asia if you don't, Musk explained to an online interviewer. It's a bad week for the moon, which has been added to the World Monument Fund's list of vulnerable heritage sites. WMF President Benedicte de Montlaw said private space exploration has created an urgent need to recognize and preserve lunar artifacts, including footprints left on the moon by Apollo astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin in 1969. Finally, it was a bad week for Comity. After a heated exchange in a House committee between Representatives Jasmine Crockett, Democrat from Texas, and Nancy Mace, Republican from South Carolina, ended with Mace suggesting to Crockett over the futile banging of the chairman's gavel that she might want to take it outside. Short in other news piece here. Immigrant detention bill passes Senate on bipartisan vote. 12 Democrat senators joined with the Republicans this week to pass the Laken-Riley Act in a 64-35 vote, setting the immigration crackdown bill on a path to clear Congress and be signed into law by President Trump. Currently, federal law requires detention of undocumented immigrants only when they are accused of the most serious crimes, such as rape and murder. The Laken-Riley Act, named for a University of Georgia student who was murdered by a Venezuelan migrant who had been arrested and released several times, expands the list of detainable charges to include burglary, theft, assault on law enforcement officer, and crimes that cause serious bodily harm. A provision would also let state attorneys general sue the federal government for failing to enforce immigration laws. Critics warn that the legislation will undermine the due process rights of people who have not been convicted of crimes. This week's briefing is titled, The Scramble for Greenland. The massive Arctic island is vital to U.S. interest, whether or not President Trump buys it from Denmark. Why does Trump want Greenland? The president insists that U.S. ownership of the world's largest island is an absolute necessity for national security, and has refused to rule out the use of military force to acquire the self-governing Danish territory. Defense experts disagree with Trump's takeover threats. Most advocate for closer ties with Greenland and NATO ally Denmark, but they agree that Greenland is strategically crucial to the U.S., three times the size of Texas and home to just about 57,000 people. The island is a buffer against Russia and China as the Arctic ice melts, opening new shipping routes between North America, Europe, and Asia. The U.S. has maintained a military presence in Greenland since World War II. The Pituffik Space Base, some 750 miles north of the Arctic Circle, today houses 200 personnel and a ballistic missile early warning and defense system. But Trump argues the U.S. needs more control over Greenland to keep up with the great power race now playing out in the Arctic. I'm talking about protecting the free world, Trump said. You have China ships all over the place. You have Russian ships all over the place. Many foreign policy analysts agree that the U.S. needs to step up its involvement in the region. We've sort of been asleep at the switch, said Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution. What are China and Russia doing? In recent years, Russian President Vladimir Putin has reopened dozens of closed Soviet-era military bases in the far north, built four nuclear-powered icebreakers capable of smashing through 13-foot-thick ice, The U.S. has two icebreakers, both decades old, and carried out Arctic tests of hypersonic missiles designed to evade U.S. defenses and sensors. That materiel could help Russia assert its claims to a swath of disputed Arctic territory and turn the Northern Sea Route, a once frozen passage along its own Arctic coast, into a new Suez Canal, through which Russian oil and gas could be quickly shipped to Asia. China has also invested in the Northern Sea Route, which would slash the time it takes to ship Chinese products to Europe. And in Greenland has tried unsuccessfully to buy mineral rights, airports, and an abandoned Danish naval base. Jahara Matisik, a professor at the U.S. Naval War College, said the U.S. believes China's real interest in those Greenland projects was to install dual-use equipment that could help control its own military satellites and spy on nearby U.S. operations. If China can disrupt our kill chain, our space-based assets, our satellites, then we will struggle to shoot things down, said Matisik. That's why Greenland ends up actually mattering a lot. Other experts believe China's goal is more straightforward, to box the U.S. out of Greenland's vast mineral riches. What resources are there? Greenland has significant reserves of rare earths, plus graphite, copper, nickel, cobalt, and lithium. Those minerals are critical to the production of green energy technology, such as wind turbines and electric vehicle batteries, as well as artificial intelligence chips and cutting-edge military equipment. But China currently dominates the market for many of those raw materials. It controls about 70% of global rare earth output, leaving the U.S. dangerously reliant on its superpower competitor. Greenland also has large deposits of uranium and up to 52 billion barrels of oil, worth about $4 trillion. America's interest in the island is about natural resources, said Trump's National Security Advisor Mike Waltz. It's all part of the America First agenda. Can those riches be extracted easily? No, which is why the island currently has only two active mines. Most of the critical minerals lie in the craggy hills along the coast, and any new mine will face high startup costs. The weather is hostile. Temperatures in the north drop to an average of minus 4 degrees Fahrenheit in winter, and so is the terrain. While the Greenland ice sheet has shrunk by some 2,000 square miles over the past four decades, it still covers 80% of the island and is 2 miles thick at its deepest point. There are no roads between towns, and the iceberg-clogged waters make shipping dangerous. Outside workers will also likely need to be brought in because of the small local population. There has always been a lot of hype, a lot of talk of the potential in Greenland, said Flemming Gertrøer Christensen, a Danish geoscience consultant. Trump's interest may wake up interest now, but the challenges remain the same. What do Greenlanders want? Self-determination. A Danish colony for more than two centuries, Greenland secured home rule and established its own parliament in 1979. Much of the population, which is 90% native Inuit, is now eager for true independence. Greenlanders are very tired of being treated like second-class citizens, said Ulrik Pram God, a researcher at the Danish Institute for International Studies. Greenlandic Prime Minister Mette Egede announced this week that work on an independence framework has begun and hinted that an independence referendum could be held in April. Independence would be expensive. Denmark spends about $1 billion a year on the island, about $17,500 per Greenlander, and covers half of its budget. Some residents argue that once independent, Greenland could enter a free association compact with America, under which the U.S. would provide economic support in exchange for access to resources. Egede has expressed interest in greater cooperation with the U.S., but nothing more. We are not for sale, and will never be for sale, he said. The future is ours and ours to shape. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. Why Doge will get nowhere. D-O-G-E. Elon Musk's so-called Department of Government Efficiency will quickly run into an insurmountable math problem, said Kevin D. Williamson. Doge, as Musk has called this vanity hobby project, supposedly will identify ways to cut $2 trillion out of the $7.4 trillion federal budget. Musk recently admitted he'd settle for $1 trillion, but he has no authority to order any cuts and will quickly find that Congress will resist anything but superficial snipping. Meaningful fiscal reform has to include major cuts in Medicare, Social Security, and the military. But President Trump has repeatedly insisted he won't cut retirement entitlements, and at a time of rising tensions with an expansionist China, reducing defense spending is a non-starter with most Republicans. That leaves non-defense discretionary spending, but that entire category totaled $917 billion in 2023. You could cut every nickel of it. All of the money the federal government spends on education, scientific research, highways, national parks, law enforcement, etc., without eliminating $1 trillion. It would take great moral leadership and political skill to persuade voters to accept major sacrifices to popular spending programs. Does the richest man in the world have those attributes? Texas wages war on Catholic group. Religious freedom has come under a remarkably punitive and malicious attack from Texas Republicans, said David French. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton's office is targeting Annunciation House, a Catholic nonprofit that provides shelter, food, and clothing to hundreds of migrants in El Paso. Lawyers from Paxton's office showed up at Annunciation House last year and demanded immediate access to records regarding its past and current residents, saying it suspected the charity was illegally harboring undocumented migrants. When the group tried to block Paxton's subpoena, Texas moved to revoke its state charter and shut it down, an attack on the shelter's religious rights. Paxton, a MAGA supporter, said Texas religious freedom law doesn't protect Annunciation House because the organization doesn't offer mass or confessions. This is ludicrous. Serving the poor is one of the purest forms of religious service that exist, endorsed by more than 2,000 passages in the Bible. It's not Christian to deprive migrants of food and shelter. The case is now before the Texas Supreme Court. Clearly, when MAGA has to choose between its professed Christianity and hunting down migrants, it will choose cruelty and hypocrisy every time. This column comes from Canada. Why America will never conquer us. Canada isn't bothered by President Trump's bluster over annexing us as the 51st state, said Stephen March. We're confident that we can't be pressured by economic force. And as for military force, America tried that in 1812 and failed, largely because of the incompetence and arrogance of the American commanders. Little has changed. America has just come off of 70 years of failed imperialist adventures in which it discovered it couldn't hold on to Afghanistan or Iraq or Vietnam or anywhere else. Its military footprint is shrinking as it gets kicked out of African bases, and it's less united than ever. Right now, ordinary people with Ivy League degrees are assassinating CEOs on the streets of New York, to widespread approval. Indeed, assassination attempts are practically becoming routine, with two against Trump last year. The nation isn't even willing to invest enough in its public services to put out fires in its second largest city. The truth is, America has never been weaker in our lifetimes. It has undergone a complete collapse of national solidarity, with red voters pitted against blue. And it doesn't seem to understand it is under attack from both Russia and China in a hybrid war. Honestly, Canada isn't afraid of America. We're afraid for America. Time for the last word, our feature article. If dogs could talk. A growing number of gadgets claim to help pets communicate with their owners, said Imogen West Knights in The Economist's 1843 magazine. But do our animals have anything interesting to say? Something was wrong with Bunny. Her owner, Alexis Devine, an artist and jewelry designer in her 40s, had just brought her back from a walk near their home in Tacoma, Washington. Normally, Bunny, a bubbly young sheepadoodle, would be exhausted, but today she wouldn't settle down. For most dog owners, this would be the beginning of a frustrating guesswork process. Was Bunny hungry? Did she need to go to the toilet? Was she bored? Divine, however, had a secret weapon. Bunny trotted over to a patchwork of brightly colored hexagonal mats on the floor of the living room and placed her paw on one of a series of buttons. Mad, it said in Divine's disembodied voice. The dog looked expectantly at her owner. Why mad? Divine asked. Bunny pressed another button, prompting the voice to say, ouch. Where ouch, Divine replied. The dog pressed the buttons for stranger and paw. Divine checked Bunny's paws. Embedded in some matted fur on the bottom of her front left paw was the stranger, an inch-long foxtail spike. A video of this interaction went viral on TikTok in October 2020. Of course it did. Who wouldn't want to see a video of a talking dog? As long as humans have had imaginations, they have dreamed of communicating with other animals, of chatting with a cheetah and cursing in fluent kangaroo, as a song from a musical adaptation of Dr. Dolittle put it. Any apparent progress toward that goal sets pet owners' pulses racing. Bunny is one of a growing cohort of dogs worldwide who are now using these buttons, known as augmentative and alternative communication, AAC boards, to express themselves. It's an open question whether they are intentionally communicating, memorizing combinations of actions, or doing something else entirely. But an answer may be forthcoming. 2,000 of these dogs are currently being studied by researchers at the University of California, San Diego, as part of an unusually large citizen science study. Over the years, many have tried to crack the challenge of what it takes to communicate effectively with animals. Will it soon be possible to call our pets not just our companions, but our confidants? If you think of the books and films you enjoyed as a child, it's likely that the protagonist was a talking animal. Babar, Aslan, Peter Rabbit, Baloo, any of the 101 Dalmatians. Or maybe it was a human who could talk to animals. Dora the Explorer, for instance, can yap for hours with her best friend, a monkey named Boots. There are countless fables, fairy tales, and stories from around the world in which humans possess the ability to speak to animals and vice versa. The seeds for the UC San Diego study were sown in 2013 when Leo Trottier, an entrepreneur and cognitive scientist, adopted two cats. Like many animal lovers, he dreamed of tapping into his pet's intelligence, and later that year founded a company called Clever Pet, which makes stimulating toys for animals. Its flagship product, a machine that releases food to reward a dog for pressing buttons in a certain order, proclaims itself to be the world's first game console for dogs. In 2019, Trottier noticed a new social media trend, people trying to start a conversation with their pets. Some owners had developed simple, labeled buttons that their pets pressed when they wanted something, like water. He got in touch with a few people to find out more about how their animals were interacting with these buttons, including Divine, Bunny's owner. Trottier was impressed with the owner's inventiveness, but also sensed a business opportunity. They were really calling out for some purpose-built devices, he told me. By June 2020, Trottier had launched Fluent Pet, a company that makes customizable AAC boards specifically designed for dogs. The company now also markets its buttons to cat owners. For $65, Fluent Pet sells a starter kit of buttons, to which owners can affix labels featuring common commands and expressions, such as outside, play, cuddle, and water. Owners then customize the buttons by adding a recording of their own voice. As a dog becomes more proficient at using the kit, an owner can buy extra buttons and program them to express more complex concepts. Bunny, who is now 5 years old, is working with 100 buttons, including time expressions such as soon and question words such as why. As Fluent Pet got off the ground, Trottier kept a close eye on his device's early adopters. Bunny seemed to be doing things that scientists had generally thought dogs couldn't do, such as combining tokens, the term linguists use for basic units of language, to make new expressions. He felt that Bunny's actions could be of scientific interest and contacted Federico Rosano, a comparative psychologist at UC San Diego. Scientists first started to get interested in animal communication in the 19th century. In 1872, Charles Darwin examined the evolutionary connection between animal and human physical expressions of emotion, such as smiling. 25 years later, Ivan Pavlov demonstrated that dogs could be trained to associate a cue, a ringing bell, with a reward, food. From the 1960s, there was a surge of interest in animal speech, fueled in part by the cognitive revolution in psychology, when scientists first began to assert that animal intelligence differed from human intelligence only in sophistication, not kind. Many of the resulting studies have been discredited. Some were based on the behavior of a single creature. Often these animals, usually primates, were isolated from the rest of their species in a lab and trained for hours a day to use sign language or recognize symbols. Trottier assured Rosano that he would take care to avoid the greatest traps in animal communication studies. The pets would live at home, meaning that their routines could continue with minimal disruption. He was also confident he could rustle up a large sample size, increasing the accuracy and breadth of the study. Even so, Rosano was wary, he told me. I thought, well, I don't know if there's anything to see. Probably not. Today, around 2,000 pets from 47 countries are participating in the study. Owners are asked to film the dogs using the buttons and fill in surveys on their pets' behavior. Periodically, research assistants visit the dogs' homes to verify the owners' claims. Rosano and his team hope to establish whether dogs can indeed learn to associate the words on the buttons with their meanings and make simple requests with them. If they manage to do that, Rosano wants to explore more complex questions, including whether Fluent Pets boards could be used to help pets who have two-way conversations. The study, which began in 2020, will run for several more years. In the meantime, Rosano says he has been surprised by what the animals seem to communicate about. Some Dogs refer to things and people that are not present, making requests for food or assistance on behalf of other animals in their household, or seemingly remember past events. Cash, a golden retriever involved in the study, lives with his owner, Christina Lee, on the outskirts of San Francisco. Cash often uses his buttons to talk about past events, Lee told me. Once, his fur became matted by burrs as he walked through a field. It took Lee 3 hours to get him untangled. Later that day, Cash pressed the button he had with the name of the field, as well as the one for worried. Dogs are thought to have the linguistic capacity of a human toddler. But what about my cat, Sushi 2, a 2-year-old mackerel tabby? As a paid-up member of the Crazy Cat Lady Club, I would obviously like to be able to hold long and meaningful conversations with Sushi 2 about her hopes and dreams. I may be waiting a long time, however. Cats, it seems, are a tougher nut to crack than dogs. Juicy Carlgren, a Swedish computational linguist with an interest in animal communication, told me that cats don't have as many facial muscles with which to make expressions as dogs do. Cats are stiff in their faces, he said, which is why they express themselves through meowing. And while kittens will meow at their mothers, adult cats reserve their meows for humans. When adult cats do communicate with one another, out of aggression or fear, it's usually through hissing or yowling. Either they meow to us because they think we're mums, their mums, or alternatively, they think we're kittens, explained Carlgren. Other researchers, most prominent among them the Swedish linguist Suzanne Schultz, believe that cats use different kinds of meows, depending on the circumstances, in order to elicit specific responses from humans. Javier Sanchez, an engineer from Washington State who worked on Amazon's Alexa device, was listening to the radio a few years ago when his ears pricked up. Schultz was giving an interview in which she claimed that humans could interpret their cats' meows. Sanchez, who has 5 cats, got to work developing a device that could translate cats' meows. His first idea was for a gadget that a cat would wear on its collar and that would play the translation out loud. Specifically, I wanted Samuel L. Jackson's voice, he told me. This proved too difficult to implement, though, so instead Sanchez designed an app for smartphones. Using a Google program for classifying sounds, the app distinguishes meows from other noises. It then translates the meow according to a cat-human dictionary that he and the data scientist Stavros Talapiris have developed based on vocalization data sets. I'm in love, a cat might be trying to tell you, or if it's displeased with you, we're fighting. Eager to hear what Sushi 2 had to tell me, I downloaded the app, which is called Meow Talk. I quickly became frustrated with it. The phone had to be in the same room as my cat to hear her meowing. But cats can't be persuaded to do things they don't want to do. The meows that it did manage to translate were Sushi 2's demands to be let into a room. Since I could hear her outside the door clawing at the carpet, this was hardly a revelation. Naomi, a woman in her 30s who lives in London with Waffle, her 7-year-old British short hair, also downloaded Meow Talk. Waffle's favorite phrase, apparently, is, "Don't ignore me," which Naomi finds ironic. I'm literally always paying him attention and begging him to hang out with me. The truth, Sanchez told me, is that cats don't have all that much to say. You're not going to get to complex sentences, and you're not going to get a conversation. That's just not there. Even Schultz has acknowledged that about 90% of cats' meows are simply cries for attention. In late 2023, I met Ovi, a 7-year-old schnauzer, and his owner, Mika Agnihotri, at their home in North London. Agnihotri and Ovi had been participating in the UC San Diego study for 3 years. At the time, Ovi was just shy of 50 fluid fat buttons, which included words such as high and scratches. On drizzly days, said Agnihorty, the dog will repeatedly paw at the rain button, apparently wanting to make small talk about the weather. Agnihorty is under no illusion Ovi is capable of engaging in a complete conversation like you and me, but she believes the device has improved Ovi's quality of life. They live for so little time, and if I could just do anything that would make his life a bit better, I would. Ultimately, the results of Rosano studies won't matter much to many of Fluent Pet's users. Agnihorty is simply grateful that she and Ovi had their own private code to work with. And maybe it is this intimacy and inscrutability that keeps us enthralled by our pets. If I knew what caused Sushi 2 to suddenly dart from a room, or what she meant when she mouthed at nothing in a corner, perhaps the mundanity of her thoughts would disappoint me. As it is, I enjoy the puzzle. A longer version of this article appeared in 1843 magazine. Pick up one of the obituaries this week. The third-rate player who became Mr. Baseball, Bob Uecker, 1934 to 2025. Bob Uecker turned a humdrum major league career into comedy gold. Hired as the Milwaukee Brewers play-by-play announcer in 1971, he mined his lackluster years as a reserve catcher for endless anecdotes, a shtick he kept up for more than 50 years. Johnny Carson adored him, dubbing him Mr. Baseball, and inviting him on The Tonight Show over 100 times. By the 1980s, he was doing film and TV spots, and Miller Lite had a whole ad campaign built around him. In one iconic 1984 ad, Uecker walks through the stands at a game, talking about the great perks he gets as an ex-player, and plops down in a box. When an usher says his free tickets are actually elsewhere, he chirps, "I must be in the front row." Cut to Uecker sitting in the nosebleeds. The spot was so beloved that the bleachers became known as the Uecker seats, and the Brewers erected a statue of him there. "I think when I finally go, I might want to go like that," he said in 2014, seated and above ground. A Milwaukee native, Robert George Uecker, signed with his hometown team in 1956. Making his first major league debut as a catcher in 1962. Then he bounced around with the St. Louis Cardinals, Philadelphia Phillies, and Atlanta Braves. But his futility as a baseball player doomed his career, said the Washington Post. With a career batting average of just .200, he distinguished himself mostly by leading the National League in 1967 in both passed balls, pitches he should have caught, and errors. Still, he was a first-string clubhouse comedian who, on leaving the sport, honed his experiences into a comedy act with himself as the butt of the joke. The Mickey Mantle of self-deprecation, he possessed perhaps the driest dry wit in sports history, said the Wall Street Journal. That got him onto Carson, onto ABC's Monday Night Baseball, and ultimately into acting. He played an inebriated say-anything version of himself in the 1989 film Major League and its sequels, said the New York Times, and a sports writer on the sitcom Mr. Belvedere. But his true love was calling games, which he did through last season. "All the television stuff, the movies, the sitcoms, the commercials, that's all fun," he said in 2003. "But all I wanted to do is come back to Milwaukee every spring to do baseball." Here's one of the health and science pieces. Toxins linger after fires are out. Even after the devastating wildfires in Los Angeles are brought under control, the health effects will be felt for years to come, reports the New York Times. Smoke from the forest fires is bad enough. It generates air pollution that lingers for days, harming the health of everyone, but particularly of the elderly, the young, and the ill. Wildfire smoke already causes more than 500,000 deaths a year worldwide, and that total is climbing as the number and intensity of fires rises due to climate change. But when blazes burn through densely populated cities, the resulting smoke is far more hazardous. It is laden with the poisons from all the incinerated debris of urban life. Chemically treated furniture, clothes, and housing materials, melted metal and plastics from cars and electronics. One recent study has found that even homes that aren't destroyed by a nearby fire can harbor toxins the smoke brought inside. Toxins that linger unseen on rugs, sofas, and drywall, creating long-lasting health hazards. The pink flame retardant used to tame wildfires also leaves behind heavy metals such as cadmium. We're breathing in this toxic brew of volatile organic compounds and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons and hexavalent chromium, said Lisa Patel, executive director of the Medical Society Consortium on Climate and Health. All of it is noxious. And we've got time for one of the Talking Points articles. We'll go with oligarchy, a threat to American democracy. At President Trump's inauguration this week, a clear picture took shape of what the country's new ruling class looks like, said the Miami Herald in an editorial. Sitting a row ahead of Trump's own cabinet was a cast of magnates worth more than $1 trillion combined. Among them were Tesla CEO Elon Musk, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg, and Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. These tech billionaires all helped Trump. Musk spent $250 million on his election campaign. Zuckerberg allowed right-wing disinformation to flourish on his platforms. Bezos killed a Washington Post editorial endorsing Kamala Harris. And they now stand to grow even richer under a president who values loyalty and the currying of favors. President Joe Biden warned us of this during his farewell address last week, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Borrowing from Dwight Eisenhower, he lamented the rise of the tech industrial complex, an oligarchy that really threatens our entire democracy. Now that tech industrial complex may have its own man inside the Oval Office. Such assessments seem far too bleak, said the economist. For starters, the supposed technoligarchs control too small a slice of the economy to meaningfully guide its direction. Tesla, Amazon, and Meta, along with Apple and Google, whose CEOs also attended the swearing-in, together account for only about 3.1% of U.S. gross domestic product. Compare that with Hungary, a real oligarchy, where buddies of Prime Minister Viktor Orban oversee up to 30% of the economy. Biden's real problem is that tech moguls are putting less of their wealth into Democratic coffers, said Noah Rothman in National Review. He didn't call Zuckerberg an oligarch when the Meta chief donated hundreds of millions of dollars to liberal causes, or when Meta censored some COVID-related post at his official's behest. No, what made Zuckerberg and company suddenly transform into oligarchs was their support for Republican politicians and their policy preferences. Trump may eventually regret their support, said Peter Hamby and Puck. In and out of the White House, Trump has shown a magical ability to convince voters that he's still a populist outsider. But how long can he plausibly claim to rail against the elites, against a deep state Silicon Valley cabal, when Democrats are out of power? Zuckerberg is kissing up to him, and Musk is shaping policy as an advisor. Trump's foes are diminished, but flanked by Bezos, Zuckerberg, and Musk, the president gifted them an image to use: a government of the wealthy, by the wealthy, for the wealthy. And a few of the short notes. Excluding the Los Angeles wildfires, six of the top 10 most expensive natural disasters in U.S. history have taken place in the past 10 years. Three of those came after 2020. Hurricane Helene, $78.7 billion in damage. Hurricane Ida, 2021, $84.6 billion. And Hurricane Ian, 2022, $119.6 billion. Number one is Hurricane Katrina in 2005, which caused $201.3 billion in damage. Within hours of Trump being sworn in as president, the Oval Office was redecorated to his demands. A portrait of President Andrew Jackson now hangs in a prime spot. A bust of Winston Churchill, removed by President Joe Biden, has returned. And a valet button to order Diet Cokes once again sits on the Resolute desk. Dozens of commercial airplanes were forced to change course last week to avoid blazing debris from a SpaceX rocket that exploded 10 minutes after launching from South Texas. Shards of the rocket fell across the island nation of Turks and Caicos, sending out sonic booms as they plunged through the atmosphere. "It felt like an earthquake," said one resident. Five people are on track to become trillionaires in the next decade if current economic trends continue, according to Oxfam. They include Tesla CEO Elon Musk, currently the world's richest person with a $430 billion fortune, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg, and Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. The wealth of U.S.'s 816 billionaires grew last year by $1.4 trillion. And a quote from Alfred Wainwright, appropriate for this rough winter we've had in Raleigh. "There's no such thing as bad weather, only unsuitable clothing." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, give us a call. It's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.